In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
As you may already know, this podcast is produced by the team behind BBC History Magazine, and we're offering you the chance to try 6 issues of Britain's best-selling history magazine for just £9.99. That's a saving of 72% on the shop price. To find out more and take advantage of this offer, visit buysubscriptions.com/podcast. And if you're based in the US, you can subscribe for just $49.99 for 13 issues, saving 65%. To find out more and for all other countries, head to buysubscriptions.com/podcast. Both these offers end on the 15th of May, 2021. And welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. The Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962 saw a confrontation between the United States and the Soviet Union escalate to the edge of nuclear war. Historian Serhii Plokhii is the author of a new account of the crisis, Nuclear Folly. And in today's episode, he spoke to Matt Elton about how the crisis unfolded and the factors that led the two sides back from the brink.
So your fascinating new book explores the Cuban Missile Crisis. Do you think it's fair to say that it was one of the most perilous moments that the world has ever faced?
Well, I am certainly prepared to say that. Again, I had my doubts before I started my research on this book, and I frankly thought that it was maybe a little bit overrated in terms of how close we got to the nuclear war, but I don't have that kind of doubts anymore. There is a couple of episodes that I discuss in my book where the nuclear war didn't start just by sheer luck. The captain of the Soviet submarine already gave order to prepare for firing the nuclear-tipped torpedo. And only because of an accident, a signalman got stuck with his searchlight in the hatch of the submarine that the order was not implemented, that gave additional 20 seconds or something like that to a senior commander to see that the submarine was not actually under attack. And what that means is that while the previous, or at least the dominant narrative of the crisis places a lot of emphasis on the decision-making process, in Washington in particular, there are other components of the crisis that are less known to the general public and to many scholars as well. And they involve the decision-making process in Moscow, but also the cases where the two leaders, Khrushchev and Kennedy, really lost control over their troops, either on the ground or in the air, and where the decision to start or not to start a nuclear war, to launch or not to launch the nuclear-tipped torpedo, was not even in the hands of those leaders that we are so much fascinated with them, with their decision-making, and that get lion's share of attention. Fairly enough, but again, the most scary moments were the moments where they really were not in control, and the submarine episode is one of those.
To rewind for people who may not be wholly familiar with what we mean when we talk about this crisis. When can we say it started? When can we trace its roots back to? And who were the? What was the sort of political situation that led to it?
Well, the crisis really started in the discovery of the Soviet missiles on Cuba came in mid-October 1962. The decision by Khrushchev to put missiles on Cuba were made a few months before that, in late May and early June of 1962. But answering your question, I would put the start and the beginning of the crisis even 1 year earlier, and that would be April of 1961, 60 years ago. And that was the failed invasion by the American-backed exiles to Cuba to topple the regime of Fidel Castro. Kennedy, who gave approval to go ahead with the operation, wanted that operation to be to a degree clandestine, in a sense, not to show the American hand. And when the operation started to encounter all sorts of issues and problems, because Castro was very effective in mobilizing defenses, he refused to send any American troops into the battle. For a number of reasons, political reasons, he promised new type of relations to the Latin American countries. And that led eventually to the collapse of the entire undertaking, to a major victory by Castro. But there were two important consequences of those developments. One was that Khrushchev thought that he was dealing with really very inexperienced, indecisive leader whom he can push around and who could swallow the Soviet missiles being delivered to Cuba. The other consequence was that Castro got really frightened by what happened. Both Castro and Khrushchev expected that there would be another invasion of Cuba, and this time the Americans would go all the way. And Castro really attacked almost Khrushchev with requests for help and assistance. At some point, the implicit threat was that if he doesn't get it from Moscow, he is actually going to make a closer alliance with Beijing. And these two factors, again, they originate in this failure of the Bay of Pigs invasion. So I would say that the early origins of the crisis would be almost a year and a half before it started, in a sense, before the Soviet missiles were detected on Cuba.
One of the many fascinating things about your book is that obviously this is a story that reaches such a fever pitch. There's often a lot of attention on what happened later on, but I'd never given much thought to the actual physical undertaking of putting these missiles onto the island of Cuba. Can you talk us through how that process worked and what that involved?
Well, the Soviet Union, like the Russian Empire before, were almost a landlocked empire. So it was taking decades and centuries for the Russian Tsars to get to the Baltic Sea, to get to the Black Sea. And it was not your classic maritime empire. It was land-based empire. The empire that was engaged, and then the Soviet Union was engaged in numerous wars, but all of those wars were in Europe or Eurasia. So relatively close to the borders of the empire and then the Soviet Union that were expanding all the time. Now, what we had with Cuba is for the first time, they were trying to project their power across the Atlantic, bring it all the way to Caribbean. And that was a major, major challenge. They brought more than 40,000 people to the island. They brought the ballistic missiles. They brought tactical nuclear weapons. They sent their submarines. There were four submarines. Again, they had nuclear-tipped torpedoes. So that was enormous logistical undertaking for the Soviet Union. the equipment that they had was not designed to function in the tropical or subtropical conditions. It was designed to function in the far north or in Europe. There was a logistical problem. The other issue was that they had to do that in secret, right? Khrushchev didn't want Kennedy to know about the missiles until they were battle ready, and then he would announce that they were there. So for the secrecy reasons, they were sending those 40,000 troops in really inhuman conditions. The guys were put in the twin decks, overheated twin decks. They were not allowed outside to breathe fresh air until they got all in the Atlantic, and even then only during nighttime. And once they were approaching Cuba again, all this possibility to be on the attack disappeared as well. That contributed at the end to the probably one of the major U.S. intelligence failures in the U.S. history, or certainly in the history of the 20th century, because the U.S. was late to detect the missiles. They, at the end, estimated that there were only 10,000 instead of 43,000 troops on the island. They never learned until the end of the Cold War that there were also tactical weapons. But the price that the Soviet soldiers and sailors and others paid for that was really enormous. I have an episode in my book where I describe that one of the people on the board of the Soviet ship had appendicitis, and they wouldn't leave him in the hospital somewhere in the Mediterranean. They were okay with him dying on the ship after the operation that didn't go well. But the main concern was secrecy. So they were prepared to pay for that secrecy with lives and certainly with a lot of suffering. But they got what they wanted in terms of secrecy.
So what was Kennedy's reaction when he was told about the situation?
Well, his first words were, "He can't do that to me." which again, I had to explain, who is he? And it was about Khrushchev. And Kennedy was taking that quite personally. He called Khrushchev later in conversation with his brother Robert Kennedy a liar, and he added a couple of words that I don't think I can actually I can mention on air. So Kennedy was really upset, and the reason for that was that Khrushchev promised to him both through the official communication but also through the back channel that they had that he would do nothing to upset Soviet-American relations before the end of the year, before the congressional elections that the United States had in November of 1962. And he also promised not to put or declared that he would never put the offensive missiles on Cuba, saying that we don't need that, we have enough ballistic missiles. That was official statement. So Kennedy looked at that as really a personal betrayal. So he can't do that to me. So forget the Soviet Union, forget the United States. He can't do that to me. And what that meant was that from the start go of the crisis, when it started to explode really with the discovery of the missiles, there was zero trust between the two leaders. And the idea that, okay, you can engage diplomacy and you can talk to Khrushchev and somehow solve out those things was not really on the agenda. Again, there would be a lot of correspondence between the two leaders, but there was zero trust. The irony of the situation is that the experience of the crisis frightened and scared the two leaders enough to rebuild that trust. And the foundation for the trust was that both of them feared the nuclear war. Both of them didn't want that nuclear war to happen. So the crisis ends with something absolutely unbelievable. The solution to the crisis is based on trust. One, Kennedy promises not to attack Cuba. right? So that is the foundation of the deal. Another foundation of the deal is that he promises that 6 months from the moment when they agreed on that, he would withdraw the American missiles from Turkey, the Jupiter missiles, and that Khrushchev would not tell anybody that that was part of the deal. And the most amazing thing actually is that both of them stuck to that deal. Neither Khrushchev was not talking about the American missiles in Turkey, and Kennedy honored, of course, his promise not to invade Cuba. The transformation absolutely unbelievable, and foundation for that level of trust that eventually developed was that they realized that the guy on the other side doesn't want the nuclear war as much as I don't want it.
Other than being united by this fear of nuclear war, is it fair to say that these two figures, Kennedy and Khrushchev, were otherwise polar opposites? And did your research in the course of this book change your view of them at all?
Well, they were polar opposite in many ways. Kennedy was born in 1917, the year of the Russian Revolution. Born to a family of a millionaire, and so in that sense was an embodiment of American capitalism, whether you look at that from the United States, from Britain, or from the Soviet Union. Khrushchev was really, his career was as a political leader, was shaped by the Russian Revolution. He went into the Red Army, he joined the Communist Party there. And the revolution also really didn't allow him to get proper education. He was very talented in many ways, but he didn't have formal education. When, of course, Kennedy goes to Harvard, and from that point of view, in terms of the generations, in terms of the educational background, in terms of what kind of politics propelled those two people to the top of their respective countries, those two leaders could not be more different. And another important issue where they were different was that Kennedy was extremely inexperienced. And Khrushchev saw that. After their first meeting in Vienna in 1961, he commented to his aides that, well, this man is really inexperienced and almost immature. And that was also one of the reasons why he thought that he could get away with missiles on Cuba. So they're very different. What unites them at the end is this concern about the possibility of the nuclear war. In terms of whether I was surprised by looking at their biographies, there were a couple of things in both cases where I learned something that I didn't know about, and I said, wow. With Khrushchev, that was his visit in 1959 to the United States, so it was before Kennedy. And that, for me, tells a lot about him and his personality. So to show off, he is flying to the United States at the Soviet airplane that at that time was the biggest airplane in the world. The problem is that it is not tested. And the engineers find that there are little, very small cracks in the engine that can grow big. But Khrushchev says, no, I'm flying to the United States on that plane. And what they do along the route on the Atlantic, they place the Soviet ships all the way from Gibraltar to New York in the case there is an emergency landing of the airplane. But he is prepared to take that kind of risk to make an impression on the world opinion, to make an impression on Eisenhower. And that told me a lot about the man. You could really expect a lot of crazy things from him. In terms of Kennedy, I was surprised, again, it goes against the dominant narrative of the crisis, that during the first week of the crisis, he was a hawk. he was someone who was advocating against members of his executive committee of the National Security Council. He was advocating the idea of the air attack on the missile sites on Cuba, which we now know would probably lead to certainly a war and most likely nuclear war, because Khrushchev considered giving the right to the commanders on the ground to use the tactical nuclear weapons in defense. So from that point of view, if Kennedy would succeed during the first week, probably we would end up with the maybe regional, but certainly a war and a very possible nuclear war as well. And again, that comes out of his inexperience. That comes out of him really being vulnerable to the political pressures, because his main concern at that time during the first week is, if I do nothing, I would be impeached. So, and again, when you read that kind of statements caught on tape, on the secret tapes that Kennedy had in the White House, again, for me, that was surprising. It was also scary. It was scary in both cases, for learning the things that I just described about Khrushchev and learning about Kennedy's position during the first week of the crisis.
And it took Kennedy and his advisors, I think, almost a whole week to come up with a response. What was their response in the end? And did it take Khrushchev by surprise?
Well, they spent 1 week really going back and forth on what to do. And eventually decided to declare blockade, not to allow any new weapons to Cuba. But blockade, technically, in the international law, means the act of war. So they called it quarantine. The reason why they thought that they could take this 1 week to deliberate was that Kennedy's consideration of how long it would take to leak the news to the media in the United States. So the concern was not how long it would take the Soviets to get the missiles ready. How much time do we have? But how much time do we have before the news leaked to the media? The problem was, of course, that during that week, that was exactly the week that the Soviets needed to get their missiles ready. So by the time Kennedy goes on TV and declares the imposition of the blockade called quarantine, at least a couple of the Soviet missile squadrons or missile sites, they're already prepared to fire, and they can get, in terms of the range, they can get as far as Washington, D.C. and suburbs of New York at that time.
And was there surprise from the other side about their response?
Well, on the other side, there was a relief. There was a relief because they were, I also realized it's not just leaders, probably all of us, of course. We are shaped by our previous experiences. And for Khrushchev, the previous experience with Cuba was Kennedy's landing on the island. So that was the expectation, and they thought that that would happen, and they discussed different scenarios of what to do, either to allow the commanders to use the nuclear tactical weapons, or to say that, well, we turn this nuclear arms to Castro. So now the United States is involved in war with Cuba, and we have nothing to do with that. So that was one. And so when they learned that there was just a blockade, they said, okay, thank God. He's not the immediate threat of the war disappeared. And then Khrushchev, he immediately started to retreat, but was doing that in the way that was not immediately obvious to Kennedy. And again, Khrushchev was in retreat from the very beginning, but was being Khrushchev and quite adventurous, was bargaining and doing this and that. So at the end, the situation was getting worse and worse from one day to another, to a degree that Khrushchev loses control over his troops on Cuba, and his generals, against the orders from Moscow, order a shutdown of the American airplane U-2, which very well could trigger the war if Kennedy was inclined to respond in kind. So there was already a shooting war starting.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
We are maybe not in the middle of the new arms crisis, but we are certainly at the beginning of it. And again, I hope we will not need another Cuban crisis type of a situation to remind the world that it's time to go back to the negotiation table, try to introduce the rules and verification and so on and so forth.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
What eventually led Khrushchev to stand down or perform a sort of a U-turn, I suppose?
Well, again, he was in this retreat from early on. His condition was, if we can get from Kennedy promise not to invade Cuba, we are the winners in that situation. But then he was throwing additional, of course, as negotiation tool, additional conditions. When he really decided that, okay, the time is up, it's when he learned that the two things, basically. One was that the American Strategic Air Command was on high alert DEFCON 2, which is next to the conditions of the war. And they were flying their missions not only around North America, but they were flying all the way into the Mediterranean, turning in Western Mediterranean, or Eastern Mediterranean, rather, in over Italy and Yugoslavia. So for him, that was an indication that the Americans were prepared to the war, and war not in Cuba or over Cuba, but were prepared to deliver nuclear strike at the Soviet Union. And another, of course, very, very concerning thing for him was the shooting down of U-2 plane. So he thought that, okay, this time around that could happen. And to communicate his readiness to accept Kennedy's conditions, he ordered Radio Moscow to transmit his letter, making sure that in that way it would get to the White House in no time. Because if you do that through diplomatic channels, it's amazing. Another big surprise to me, a shocking surprise, was that it was taken up to 24 hours for the letter to go from Kremlin to the American embassy. Then they couldn't just send it like that through telegraph or telephone. They have to cipher it, because those were the instructions. Then it was going to the State Department, where they had to decipher it. And then they had to bring it to White House. And you think about the time difference anywhere between 8 and 9 hours, and those are the leaders who are sleeping at that time, so that can add another 8 to 9 hours before the leader get the word from the other side. So one of things that they did after the Cuban Missile Crisis, there was this back channel, and they created a telephonic communication system where they could communicate in almost in real time. Yeah.
What's remarkable for me listening to all of this is how close it sounds like things were to at any point spiraling out of control. Is that a fair assessment?
It is. Well, there was more than one point where things really spiraled out of control. And I mentioned two of them, the episode with submarine and then the shooting down of the American airplane over Cuba. And those two involved the Soviet side. Now, the most dangerous moment of the crisis, it was Saturday, October 27, if I am not mistaken. It isn't the right date is in the book, but it seems to me October 27, that Kennedy gets a report that an American U-2 plane, another U-2 plane, that was on a mission over the North Pole to collect air samples to figure out whether the Soviets were testing nuclear weapons or not. They were doing that on the regular basis. Just lost its way because the electronic equipment didn't work properly near North Pole. So they had to orient, the pilots had to orient themselves using stars and star constellations. So he lost his way and ended up in the Soviet airspace over Chukotka. And the Soviets scrambled their MiG fighters to get to him. The U-2 was flying higher than they actually could reach, which saved it. But the Americans sent their own fighters to protect the U-2. The fighters are on high alert, and the only weapon that they have is actually a nuclear-tipped missile. So this is the only weapon that they have, and they fly trying to protect U-2 from the MiG airplanes. And the very fact that the U-2 is over the Soviet space and that it is detected by the Soviets sends really chills to the Secretary of Defense McNamara, Kennedy himself, because the expectation is the Soviets will decide that this is the last reconnaissance flight before the nuclear attack on the Soviet Union and could decide to do the first strike themselves. Eventually, again, it's dissolved and Kennedy apologizes to Khrushchev in letter, but it's already after the tensions were dissolved and the most acute stage of the crisis came to an end.
What were the political repercussions for both the Soviet leaders and those in the US?
Well, there was a dramatic change of the distribution of power in relations between the two leaders. Before the Cuban Missile Crisis and through most of the crisis, Khrushchev was really in the driving seat. He was the one who was setting the agenda, setting the pace, and Kennedy was reacting, all the time reacting. Once the Cuban Missile Crisis ended with Khrushchev's agreement to withdraw, the power relations changed completely. Now it was Kennedy who was setting the agenda, who was pushing for certain things, was prepared to take risk to the question that they disagreed on whether the deal that they reached included also the bombers capable of delivering atomic bombs. And Khrushchev was saying no, and Kennedy was saying yes, and you have to remove them, otherwise the crisis and potential threat of the war would continue. So there is a dramatic change in those terms. So Kennedy is not perceived as a weak president anymore, either in the United States or outside of the United States. And the whole thing is viewed as a defeat for Khrushchev, both outside, because what people see and what media sees is that he agreed to withdraw the nuclear missiles. What the world doesn't know that he also got out of that Kennedy's promise to withdraw the American missiles from Turkey. And Khrushchev is removed from power 2 years after the end of the crisis. And there is a connection between the Cuban Missile Crisis and his removal. I'm not trying to say that, okay, if he would, the missiles would stay in Cuba, that there would be a different outcome. But Khrushchev's colleagues, members of the party presidium, who eventually removed him, presented a long list of his sins and his missteps and so on and so forth. And Cuba was really featured really very, very prominently on that list. So that was one of the certainly contributing factor to his removal, because the people around him realized that he was really playing with the fire of the nuclear war, that it was extreme case of adventurism. They saw that he actually was scared himself. And again, that certainly didn't help him with his standing, political standing among his own peers or the members of his inner circle.
That idea of missteps is, I think, a really interesting one. Do you think it's right to see this episode as, instead of being about competence or necessarily wisdom, it's just about a series of missteps that somehow didn't lead to disaster?
Well, my book is titled Nuclear Folly. Really, the title that I wanted for that book was The March of Folly. And that the title has been already taken by Barbara Tuchman. It's a prize-winning book. But there is a connection between Barbara Tuchman and the Cuban Missile Crisis in the sense that her book, The Guns of August, where it is a lot about misunderstanding and misperception, was published a few months before the crisis. And Kennedy loved the book. He was giving it to his military commanders. And the idea of possible misstep and misunderstanding was always on his mind. But even despite of that, he couldn't actually avoid making one mistake after another. And my book is one of its contributions is actually show how many of those missteps, misunderstandings, and misperceptions were there. And signal or maybe message to us today is, yes, there are improvements in communication, that there are all sorts of other things that are different today than they were back in 1962. But this idea that the leaders are really informed by their own political trajectories, political biases, their experiences, and have difficulty understanding the other sides, either their motivations or predicting what the response of the other side would be. That is true today, in my opinion, as much as it was true back in 1962.
Do you think we're in as perilous a historical moment now then as the one we're talking about?
What I can say is that we are now in the pretty much uncontrolled nuclear arms race. And that is the situation that reminds me about the world before 1962. And the world before 1962 is uncontrolled arms race with no clear rules of this race and competition. Produces on its own crises like the Cuban Missile Crisis because the rules are not clear. The Cuban Missile Crisis scared Kennedy and Khrushchev enough to restore the process of negotiation. In 1963, they signed the first arms control agreement, which was the partial nuclear test ban, not allowing nuclear tests in the atmosphere or in the water. And then after that followed a number of other arms control and arms reduction agreements going all the way into the Reagan and Gorbachev era in the late 1980s. By now, all of those agreements signed during the Cold War, with the exception of the test ban, are gone. And the rearmament is taking really place again. The latest news from the rearmament front, of course, come from the UK with the decision of the government to raise the cap by 40% or more than 40% on the nuclear on nuclear arsenal related to the Trident missiles and Trident submarines. But again, that's just the latest piece of the news. China is already there. Russia and the United States are already there. So we are maybe not in the middle of the new arms crisis, but we are certainly at the beginning of it. And again, I hope we will not need another Cuban crisis type of a situation to remind the world that it's time to go back to the negotiation table, try to introduce the rules and verification and so on and so forth. It can be more difficult to do now than it was in the past for a number of reasons, and one of them is the rise of cyber warfare, right? Where the major question is, like it was the question during the Cuban Missile Crisis, okay, you sign an agreement, but how can you verify that the other side follows and sticks to the commitments? And they were trying to verify those things in the early 1960s with U-2 overflights, which were bringing one international crisis to another. Then eventually satellites solved the problem of verification. But we don't have an equivalent of satellites today to deal with the cyber warfare. So again, the situation is similar, but in certain ways, it's potentially is more dangerous than it was back then.
That was Serhii Plokhii. His book, Nuclear Folly, A New History of the Cuban Missile Crisis, is available now, published by Penguin. There's a link in today's show notes. Serhii is also writing a feature on the Cuban Missile Crisis for BBC History magazine. Keep an eye out for that in our upcoming July issue. If you enjoyed this episode and want to know more about the Cuban Missile Crisis, well, back in July 2020, Mark White answered listener questions on the nuclear standoff for our Everything You Wanted to Know series. You can find that by searching for Cuban Missile Crisis in our back catalogue. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman and Brittany Colley. Tune in tomorrow for the latest episode in our series on Britain's greatest prime ministers, in which Charlotte Riley nominates Clement Attlee. We'd love to know what you think about History Extra. So we're running a survey to ask you what you love about the podcast and what you think we could do better. It should only take 5 minutes to fill out, and you'll be entered into a prize draw for the chance to win one of 7 £100 Voucher Express gift cards. The prize draw is open to UK residents only and runs until Sunday the 16th of May. So to have your say, just head to bit.ly/HEPodSurvey, where you can also find the full terms and conditions. That's bit.ly/HEPodSurvey.